You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Donald C. Brockett, the author of The Tyrannical Rule of the U.S. Supreme Court, How the Court Has Violated the Constitution. Don, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Don, I want to talk about this book in great detail in a moment, but before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are?
Sure. I graduated from law school back in 1961 and joined the prosecuting attorney's office here in Spokane County as a deputy. In 1969, I was appointed the elected prosecutor's position and ran for office six times and was reelected, serving as the elected prosecutor for 25 years. I then left the office and ended up in private practice after a short bout with colon cancer and the treatment for it, and 7 years later decided to re-retire, and sitting around at home decided that there was something I still needed to do, which was to tell people what I thought was a concern of mine in the country in terms of what our U.S. Supreme Court has done to us.
As I might have mentioned to you prior to the interview, I have thought about this topic here recently, relatively recently, about the U.S. Supreme Court. And I'm not a lawyer, and I'm certainly not an expert on the Constitution. But it seemed to me, from the little bit I knew, that the Supreme Court was designed to rule on issues related to the United States and not the states. Is that correct?
That's totally correct.
And how did this get subverted, or to the point where we're at now? I know in your fine book you talk about the 14th Amendment. Is that the main culprit?
Well, that's the main culprit of the court ruling in state cases, but the main culprit goes way back to Justice Marshall's opinion when he decided that the court had the right of what he called judicial review. Interestingly enough, it was in a famous case called Marbury versus Madison, in which the court found it didn't have jurisdiction to rule. So that should have been the end of the case. However, Justice Marshall went on to opine, and I call it the meanderings of the judge, in what's called with the Latin term dicta, something outside of the opinion itself, that the court had the right to interpret the Constitution and, in fact, had a duty to do so. When he did that, it was interesting because the person who wrote the Constitution, Thomas Jefferson, wrote to a friend of his and said, "This is totally ridiculous that Marshall would hold this way, because that would make the court in a position to be a tyrannical rule of the people of the United States of America." And that's exactly what's occurred. They have misinterpreted the 14th Amendment, which had a specific purpose. You know, the purpose was to protect the people who had previously been slaves, who were freed by the Emancipation Proclamation. Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, guaranteeing to those freed slaves the same privileges and immunities of all other citizens at the time. The court has since then said, no, they're the privileges and immunities which we have decided to extend by our opinions, but that's not what it was for. Congress at that time, in 1866, in passing the Civil Rights Act, knew, as any Congress does, that they could be replaced in future elections. So they decided this needed to be put into an amendment to the Constitution, which ended up being the 14th Amendment, which is directed specifically at the states and tells the states that they have to guarantee privileges and immunities, due process, etc., to those freed slaves. Because what was occurring, Dave, was, for example, many of the slaves had fought in the Civil War on the winning side. And after the war, they returned to their southern states, and their weapons were being taken away from them by the southern states. Congress said, well, that's not right. These people fought on the winning side and are entitled under the Second Amendment to keep their weapons just as everyone else is in the United States of America. So we will put this into an amendment to guarantee that, in fact, that's what's occurred. Well, the court has since then, historically, as you know, interpreted words and phrases of the 14th Amendment to such an extent that you can't even recognize them. They aren't the same as they were when the amendment was passed. the court has decided to expand them. And the legislature, the Congress, which, by the way, is the strongest branch of the government, or was meant to be, and is described in Article 1, has done nothing about it. And I'm not sure exactly why that's true.
Let's go back first to Marbury versus Madison. That was 1803, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And the only reason I know that is from reading your book. In that decision, you said something called judicial review, where Marshall came up with this term, which obviously I learned from reading your fine book that the Supreme Court has come up with a bunch of terms that somehow they think should be the law of the land. When he came up with this judicial review, what was some of the reaction? Was there any reaction to it? Was he just allowed to get away with it because, as you say in the book, they did it because they could?
Well, that's exactly right. They got away with it because there was a respect for the court, which, of course, had been created under Article 3. And since the court didn't actually rule in the case, you know, they held that they didn't have the ability to rule. They had no jurisdiction over the matter. Nobody was quite concerned about it. Jefferson, of course, picked up on it immediately and wrote to his friend, as I've indicated, saying this concept of judicial review of the Constitution itself is preposterous and will result in the court becoming the sole governing body of our government.
And he was right.
And what I find is interesting about that is you mentioned one term, which I think is interesting. People say, well, this is the supreme law of the land. That's not correct. If you look at the Constitution itself, Article 6 clearly says, this Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. There is no mention of the fact that court opinions by the United States Supreme Court are the supreme law of the land. The supreme law of the land was made by the legislative branch. People at that time, our founders, had revolted against England, and they wanted their own legally elected representatives, most of them at the local level, to be their rulers. And Justice Scalia, who unfortunately passed away recently, said that in a recent opinion in the same-sex marriage case by saying, quote, what's extremely important to me is who my ruler is, end quote. And he went on to say, today's opinion says that we are ruled by 9 lawyers. Now, most people don't understand the significance of that, Dave. But for a judge to call his fellow judges lawyers is really demeaning them and putting them down and saying they don't deserve the position to which they've been appointed because they're just lawyers. And they're saying they have the ability to overturn what history has designated for all these millennia as a marriage.
Yeah, I've thought about that over the years, that really judges are simply lawyers, and they may be in their robes and be sitting up high, but at the base of it, they're attorneys, and they're human beings. And yeah, I guess a big part of the respect that is given by many people to the Supreme Court is due to that fact that they've been exalted. I wanted to bring that up as well, and that's why I said it, the supreme law of the land, because as you pointed out very clearly in your book, the supreme law of the land is Congress, and they were supposed to be the biggest part of the three branches of the federal government. But somehow the Supreme Court now has been tagged with that supreme law of the land. Did you happen to find out when that actually happened, when it switched from Congress to the Supreme Court?
Well, it happened progressively over the years after Marshall's opinion because people just basically accepted it. Now, what I don't understand is why people, of course, they don't teach civics anymore in school, don't go back and study this and find that the people who wrote the Constitution said if the court ever gets carried away and doesn't understand its position as the least important of the branches of government, they can simply be impeached. Most people say that the Supreme Court judges are appointed for life. That's not true. The Constitution says they are appointed to serve, quote, during good behavior, end quote. I would think that Congress could certainly find that a judge doesn't serve during good behavior if he decides to take off on something in the Constitution that's totally unbelievable, like finding that there's a right to dignity. Where did that right come from? That's never been in the Constitution of the United States. We recognize, because of Supreme Court cases, that there's a so-called right to privacy. Where did that come about? That's never been in the Constitution of the United States. Maybe to have a search and seizure, there has to be a warrant obtained, but that doesn't mean correspondingly that it overcomes a right to privacy. It just means that before the government can search your home or private affairs and seize anything, they have to go to a judge to make sure they have probable cause to believe that, number one, a crime has been committed, and number two, that you are a suspect who probably committed that crime. Those things in the Constitution, people don't seem to understand this, were put there to guard us against the federal government. They were meant to protect the state governments because our elected officials are closer to us. We could get into a description of the Second Amendment, which you saw in my chapter, was not as originally written. It was changed before it was ratified by the states, and it was changed for a specific reason.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, you mentioned the right to dignity. Of course, that's from Chapter 11, the same-sex marriage case. And because the Supreme Court used this term, which, like you said, does not exist in the Constitution, it should be common sense when somebody reads the Constitution, and you would think that it would be for a lawyer on the Supreme Court, that they could really put two and two together and go, wait a second here, right to dignity is not, I don't see it anywhere in the Constitution, so we can't really use this phrase here to pass this same-sex marriage law. But somehow they do this, and I know you're confused why the people don't, or somebody does in Congress, or the citizens don't come up and say, wait a second here, you're out of line, there's something wrong. But then again, I can understand it because of what you said before about people wanting to show some respect to the Supreme Court and thinking that, hey, maybe it's a form of stability, but really the reality is true. It's perversely not true that it's actually a form of instability, that they're taking apart the Constitution, and if they approve same-sex marriage for human beings, well, what's to prevent them from approving marriage with a human being and an animal?
Well, that might be a stretch, but who knows? I mean, I don't think anybody would have believed before the same-sex marriage case that they would have said that people have a right to dignity that they're being deprived of because they can't enter into a state called marriage, as opposed to just a contractual agreement between two people, which is what existed prior to that time. I thought it was interesting that Justice Thomas, in his dissent, said this is a total perversion of what our founders had in mind, because the government doesn't grant anything to the citizens. It can't give people dignity. Dignity comes from within yourself. And for us to accept the fact that we don't have dignity unless the government gives it to us is a really, really dangerous precedent.
It's almost like the majority of citizens of this once great nation have just surrendered their ability to think, and they're just handing it over to the government.
I want to say this, Dave, and you've hit the nail on the head, and I'm going to offend people, I guess, by saying this, but that's partially why I wrote the book. I want people to look at it and start a conversation and say, wait a minute, I disagree for these reasons, or wow, I never thought about it that way before. They've got to get up off their couches, quit sitting in front of the dumb media, accepting everything they're being told by them, get their noses out of their cell phones, quit worrying about whether or not their hair looks good in a selfie, and start wondering about whether or not this is the country they want to be in, because they're going to lose it. The court's taken it over. The court can declare anything it wants to now to be unconstitutional. And they're not going to have much protection from it when the federal government marches into their state. Their police departments have become militarized by having the military give them their used weapons, so to speak. I've often said under the Second Amendment, what would my governor do if he felt he needed to call the National Guard together and arm the citizens of the state? Because the federal government had decided it was going to march into the state of Washington for some reason with federal troops. He wouldn't be able to do it because he thinks none of us should have the right to possess weapons under the Second Amendment.
Now that's another thing, Don, the Second Amendment. Now the Second Amendment really was designed to only apply to the federal government, to make sure that the federal government, which was supposed to be the smallest component of our governmental system, federal government should not be allowed to have any impact on the firearms that people own, right? It doesn't have to do with the states, and that makes sense, right?
Yes, sure it does. And as I mentioned, the first draft of the Second Amendment said for the security of the nation, the states wouldn't accept that and required that it be changed to for the safety and security of the state, nobody shall ever be debarred of their weapons.
Right. So if a state, and you mentioned this in the book, if a state decides that they want to limit the ownership of firearms, they can. And if people don't like that, go to another state, right?
Well, that's called voting by your feet. The idea was that the state government is the one closest to you, and you either affect the state government by electing people in state government who carry out your will, or you go to another state where government is more agreeable to you.
Right. And people do that, I guess, nowadays. I recently moved from New Jersey to Florida, where the laws are much more liberal in Florida. In New Jersey, if you go into the Jersey Shore with a bottle of beer, you have a SWAT team on you. In Florida, you can conceal carry, no problem. I think the population of Florida is about 19 million people, and 5 years ago they passed over 1 million of the residents are concealed carry owners. In New Jersey, a military guy was trying to get a concealed carry permit because he was under the threat of terrorists, and it was denied. So I guess people do that nowadays. They do vote with their feet, as you say, and their pocketbooks.
In fact, some of the states, as you know, have passed open carry laws where you can openly carry a weapon. And I know of several people, because here in Spokane, Washington, we're close to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, that people, in fact, move to Idaho because it's a more conservative state.
Mm-hmm. And you don't really hear about, but I guess that doesn't matter with the captured, controlled corporate mainstream media, you don't really hear about legal gun owners unloading their weapons on school grounds and into restaurants and bars. But they never seem to point that out. They always seem to point out how dangerous these people are who have legally acquired firearms. It's never the criminals that they're going after. Just let me diverge a little bit from the book, but you mentioned the media. How big of a problem, Don, do you think the mainstream media is in creating the situation where we are today?
Oh, I think the media is responsible, by and large, for certainly all of the misinformation that we have and the way in which they cover things. You've mentioned part of it to talk about the weapon situation. I think it's interesting that they rarely talk about the situations where a person who had the ability to carry a weapon, either openly or concealed, was able to stop a situation by shooting the individual who was intent on shooting other people. They don't ever praise that, for example. They think that's a rarity, and it shouldn't be mentioned, apparently, to show that there's another side to this whole thing.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because they have their own agenda. It's like the Supreme Court. The majority of the Supreme Court has an agenda. I thought it was interesting that Sotomayor, in the paper this morning, had a quote speaking to a group that was just fascinating to me. She said that because they have a split of 4-4 after Justice Scalia's death, they're ruling very, very carefully and conservatively. And I thought, well, if that doesn't say the whole story, I don't know what does.
Yeah.
In other words, once you get another liberal on there, you won't have to be so careful about how you rule because you can run amok with your own agenda. I mean, be honest about it, Dave. We all basically have our own agendas. But thinking people sit down and talk with each other and say, okay, even though we have our own agendas, this is something that we kind of have to come to the middle of to be able to live with each other.
Yes.
And that's not what's happening today, which
right.
is, again, I wanted this book to stir people up. I want them to think. And then, for gosh sakes, I hope they'll act. I hope some teachers will put this book in their civics classes and they will start asking questions of their students instead of trying to mislead them by what they tell them. You know, the greatest teacher in the world, Aristotle, never taught his students anything other than by asking them questions. That's
right.
The way you educate people.
Absolutely. You're a bit older than I am, so you've seen a lot more than I have in this country. I think you said you graduated law school, was that in 1961?
Yes, I turned 80 this year.
You turned 80. God bless you, Don. I was born in 1960, so I was 1 year old when you had graduated law school. growing up in the United States in the northeast part of the country, we grew up what's now a very populated state, New Jersey. A lot different from when I grew up. We grew up next to a farm and it was peaceful. We were out all day as kids at the park riding our bicycles. We didn't have anything, as I'm sure you didn't. We had baseball cards attached to the spokes of our bikes, which made sound. And that was pretty much all we had. We were outside all day playing. And one of the things we had was the ability to think and the ability to challenge authority. Are you surprised that so many people seem to be towing the government and mainstream media line nowadays and they're not able to think for themselves?
Well, no, I'm not surprised by it because it's easier not to have to do that. And people don't stimulate themselves. They hardly read anymore or engage in discussions with other people. As I said, they sit in front of the television set and accept whatever they're being told. If they don't watch the news on TV and read it in the paper and several other outlets, they aren't actually educated about what's going on because you've got to get different perspectives of things. You can't just be given the party line, so to speak.
Right, exactly. And I've said this so many times in my interviews that I haven't watched television in now over 25 years.
The other thing that I'd mention that's interesting about that subject is the educational system because it's spoon-fed. I remember one of my grandsons telling me that he was so upset that one of his teachers constantly was voicing his opinion in the classroom, and he wanted to argue with him, but he knew if he did, he'd get a lousy grade.
Right.
So that's not education.
No, that's intimidation.
That's right.
I know we're getting away from the book a little bit, but I think it ties into the book. Are there any main culprits that you've identified in the media and educational system, a group of people that we could say, yeah, I think they bear the brunt of the blame here for this? Or is it just everybody?
Well, I don't think that anybody bears the brunt of the blame. I think all of us do to a certain extent because we've refused to argue these issues out and to see somebody else's position as a valid position. I'll tell you what I'm most disappointed in terms of writing this book. I have sent, I don't know how many different books and information about the book to professors who teach constitutional law in law schools, thinking that they might have an interest in a different opinion. Now, I can understand that when they're teaching the constitutional law, they need to teach the law students what the law is presently. But you'd think that you could do that well by teaching what the other side was as voiced by the dissenting judges in the Supreme Court itself. And that might make them better lawyers because then they could represent a different position when the client came to them. That's what the law and lawyers are supposed to do. That's what makes people mad about lawyers is they say, well, you know, you never do answer a question for me. You say, well, yes, it's true this way, but on the other hand. Well, that's what a lawyer's supposed to do. Because he's supposed to let the client make the decision. And how can the client make the decision if he or she hasn't heard both sides of the issue?
You've sent these books out, and have you had any replies?
No response.
You heard from me.
Oh, I know, but I mean from law school professors.
Right.
Who teach it. I would think they'd pick it up and call and either be mad as hell at me and say, what do you think you're doing writing a book like this? This isn't true at all. The U.S. Supreme Court hasn't turned into a tyranny. Or they'd call and say, you know what? I never thought about it this way. Glad you wrote the book. I haven't heard those opinions at all.
Haven't heard a peep. And how many did you send out, you figure, Don?
Oh, I've sent quite a few out. I don't know what the total number is.
Maybe 20 or something, 10 or 20, something like that?
At least.
Well, it's just like the mainstream media will condemn a book that they never read. They refuse to have the author on their programs. That happens all the time. So this is par for the course, I think. And what's scary is that it seems like, and that's why I mentioned the mainstream media, it seems like not just the law schools or the law professors that you reached out to or the media, but everyone is towing the same line that they just don't want to hear about alternative views. They can't handle it. They just want to hear about what the government says, what the mainstream media says. And if you try to tell me about it, well, I'm not going to listen. And of course, I'm not even going to comment on your book because I'm not going to give it the dignity of anything at all. I mean, it's horrible that you would say this about the Supreme Court, even though, as you mentioned, it wasn't you using the word tyranny of the Supreme Court. But that doesn't matter. So I'm not surprised at all, Don, that you haven't got any replies. You are, I guess, coming to this, what they might call the truth community, a little later than a lot of people. I guess you're going to be in for a lot of surprises here with your book. you probably will not get anybody to show any interest in it because it goes against what they've been taught. And like you said, they're comfortable not opposing the conventional view. Or you brought up Aristotle, like the Greeks used to do in the Agora, right? They used to spend hours discussing things and arguing positions, but that doesn't seem to exist anymore in the United States, or maybe it never did. Did it, Don? When you were growing up, was it a lot different?
Well, not really, because when I was growing up, of course, we were coming through World War II, and everybody was more concerned about defeating the terrible dictator over in Europe. But that's not how our country started. I mean, when our country started, the people who were the founders argued all of these positions vehemently because they had been under the suppression of the king, and they didn't want that ever to exist. They wanted mankind to be able to be free and to develop under a system of freedom and not be regulated by things that tied them down so much. I remember as a young prosecutor once taking a case and having an older lawyer tell me, you know what, you're just opening a can of worms by doing this. And my reaction to him was, I thought that's what lawyers were supposed to do, was open the can of worms so that the issue could be argued out. People, for example, would say, well, you can't be a defense attorney once you're a prosecutor. Well, the heck I can't. I'm a lawyer. I'm supposed to argue or be able to be on either side of a case to argue it equally well so that the fact finder has a difficult decision to make. Otherwise, right, the system doesn't make any sense.
But you've noticed that there's not very many people who share the same opinions that you do, right?
I sure have.
You know that movie, The X-Men, they're the mutants. I mean, you're kind of like a mutant, like I am, like few other people are. We're really in the minority.
I was once described as the prickly pear of Eastern Washington, so that says it all.
Yeah.
I was always the guy who wanted to say, well, wait a minute, does this make much sense? Let's look at it this way. And that's the name they assigned to me. So.
Yeah, but you were successful in your career, and you were voted in several times. And you had a long and storied career, and you always tried to do the right thing, it seems.
Well, I thought that's what you were elected for.
Right, exactly. And you were obviously were not
representing the people.
Right, but you obviously were not interested in the political end of it. You wanted to just do what was right, the way that you thought that the law was written, or the way that you know it is, and it's pretty clear how the law is written. And I guess the sorry thing is that it's gotten so far away from where we are now. And I know you bring this up in the last two chapters of your book, but do you think, Don, that we can get it back?
Sure. I mean, I'm an optimist. I always think the glass is half full and not half empty. And I think if we turn people back on, basically their light switch has been turned off, if we turn them back on and we start them thinking again and they understand the value of those principles, that people who have freedom survive better in any environment, people who aren't under the control of government. I mean, we see enough of this in the world today. Why in heavens wouldn't we understand it? We've been through world wars to make sure we fought against it. We went through a revolution to establish it for our country. Don't we think it's worth sticking to that? You'll get a kick out of this. One of the statements somebody made to me after they read the book was, you know, Don, I really enjoyed your book, but it was really technical. And I said, wow, is that true? I said, it's amazing to me that it was technical today, but in 1776, the people understood it well enough to be able to pass the Constitution.
And just for the listeners who get the book, it's not technical. It's very clear. And I should have mentioned that before. You stressed the importance in the beginning of the book of paying attention to the language of the justices who were in the minority. You mentioned that before, but I should have said that that's very important. And they don't do that. They don't pay attention to that. They just want to move on. Hey, we're all busy, right? We all have things to do, and we have families to take care of. And of course, I'm talking about people who are a functioning part of a healthy society, not the dregs of society, which you've seen plenty of in your line of work. But we all have stuff to do and places to go and people to see, and we just don't have time for these technical issues, I guess. But in the meantime, while these people are not paying attention to these technical issues, the country is slowly slipping away from us. And I think that a sign of that is how you've sent out all of your books to all of these law professors. Not one of them has gotten back. And I know you're an optimist, and I'm not trying to discourage you, Don. I don't have a very sanguine opinion about the future. I think that nothing's going to stop the decline, and that the people who should be getting off of the couch, getting away from their cell phones, like you so succinctly say, maybe even getting out of the tattoo parlors, whatever it might be that they're occupying their time with, they're not. And I don't see how they're gonna, because there's no signs that they're going to. And if they don't, then we're just going to continue down this road of decline. And there's really nothing that's going to stop it, because how important is it, or should be, to people to understand that what was designed as a reactionary, like courts are supposed to be, a reactionary, tiny little part of the Constitution should turn into such a big part. It's scary to me because, like I said, I've paid attention to this recently. But what's even more scary is what you told me, is that the people who should be worried about it are not even paying attention to it.
Well, the thing that I think lends me to have the optimistic opinion of this is that even though people may not wake up enough to understand what is being done to them, they will be concerned, or should be, about their children and their grandchildren. And they are the ones that are either going to start doing some thinking on their own as they go through their schooling, the children and the grandchildren, or the parents are going to wake up and say, wait a minute, I've kind of misled you and I haven't paid enough attention. And I do care for you very much because you're my progeny and I don't want this to continue to happen to you. So here's what we're going to do. And I think that's going to turn it around.
Well, we don't have much time. Don, if one of the listeners wants to pick up your book, where's the best place they could do it?
Well, it's listed on Amazon, and I think you've indicated that it's going to be carried by the bookstore.
Okay, and your website, Don?
The website specifically is criticalbookspublications.com.
Donald C. Brockett, the author of The Tyrannical Rule of the U.S. Supreme Court, How the Court Has Violated the Constitution. Don, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners, and looking forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thanks very much, Dave, and thanks to all of your listeners. I hope they have an interest in this and continue with education.